Welcome back, and thanks for joining us on this week's continuation of our Founder Origin series. This week, Sherry interviews Jason Cohen of WP Engine and a Smart Bear. You might know Jason from having spoken at MicroConf several times. He has one of the, in my opinion, one of the best talks about bootstrapping a startup that I've ever heard. And he's been known to frequently drop tons of startup knowledge on his blog, asmartbear.com. If you get value out of Zen Founder or out of even just this series of founder origin stories, I'd encourage you to head over to supportzenfounder.com, where we have a Patreon running, and even a couple dollars a month helps us keep the show going, pay for the editor, and helps us keep the quality of the show as high as possible. I hope you enjoy this week's episode.
We plan to talk through the issues faced by startup founders and the people close to them.
That overused phrase, work-life balance.
It is an amazingly focusing time.
This is what we do, you know, aside from our families. This is our whole work life.
I am also known as Dr. Wine.
You know, this is a little bit non-traditional.
A little more zen in the startup life. Zen founder.
Those days were a mental struggle.
I have been stressed in the past, and I know that I will be in the future.
A founder and his or her significant other will both get value from the episode.
What's your total company count at these days? How many have you founded?
Oh, four.
Four, okay. And what was your first entrepreneurial endeavor before the formal companies? When you were a kid, did you have a lemonade stand? Were there things that you were concocting to practice your entrepreneurial skills?
Yeah, I had a quote-unquote general store in elementary school with paper and pencils for people who forgot it and they could buy one for a quarter. But of course, nobody has even a quarter, so it didn't work.
Did you work on credit or trade for jelly beans? Like, how'd you work that out?
It just didn't work. I think, I don't know if I've always thought I wanted to start a company, but I definitely have always had projects. That's absolutely a thread from even very little, when I would either like write a book, you know, whatever that means in second grade, or then with the computer writing very simple programs, there was always projects. And so I think it's more like being obsessed with projects and that turning into something, rather than I want a business with a P&L and a balance sheet and employees, and how am I going to build that? That sort of came secondarily.
Like, you wanted to make something first.
Yeah.
And foremost. What kind of kid were you? How would you describe your personality as a kid?
Well, I was a class clown, but mostly in the disruptive way as opposed to the witty way. So definitely never liked being told what to do. I mean, not that everyone loves being told what to do, but almost needing to not do whatever it is that we're supposed to do. Oh, we have homework. Great. I'm going to try to get it done in a quarter of the time and then do something else. Even if that's as benign as reading a book, you know, it's not like it's a anti-establishment. It's just more like, I want to decide what to do. And then obsessive about projects again. So again, in the good and bad way, the good way in which you are able to make progress even as a kid on something, because if you spend enough hours on it, then you learn things and, I don't know, you do something. But also in the bad way of, maybe you should go outside. Maybe you should play sports.
Like that hyper focus on whatever you're making and doing and working on.
Yeah.
Was it hard for you to shift gears and like be disrupted when you were working on something?
Yeah. Didn't want to do that. It's like, you know, infinite patience and time for whatever was interesting or whatever I wanted to do, and zero patience and zero effort on whatever I didn't.
How did that go with the adults in your life?
Actually, a lot of adults, I think, including my parents and teachers, I had the attitude that this is in general going to be useful. Like, it's good to be able to focus for years on something. That is a skill. And it's part of how you become either an expert or accomplish something or whatever is the devotion of the time. And now we would say deliberate practice, right? But on the other hand, you also have to do your homework or have to do your chores or have to be a human, right? And so I think actually pretty consistently, there's this sort of balance of, we don't want to kill that part, but you have to be a complete human, which means you can't just do that. So I think I was sort of allowed to do a lot of it anyway, like as much as possible, but still have to do laundry and vacuum the floors and, you know, whatever other chores were mine as I got older. And I did play the piano since an early age, and I took karate for a while when I was a kid. So there were things there. Of course, those were also things that I was devoted to, right? But at least they were varied.
So it sounds like in some ways you got lucky in that you had parents and teachers who understood your drive and determination for the positive, for what it might lead to later, rather than seeing it as rebellious or disruptive or disrespectful or.
Yeah, I don't think you could take it as being rebellious, because it's not like I was trying to disrupt anything else. It was just I wanted to work on this story, or I wanted to work on this program, or I wanted to whatever. And like, that's clearly not trying to do something bad to somebody else.
Right.
This is clearly not the intent. So I think there was no doubt about the motivation or the intent, and that it wasn't malevolent, but it could still be extreme.
I'm a little bit surprised that you described yourself as class clown, although I know you're funny, but what about like class geek? Was that part of your identity as a kid?
So in elementary school, it wasn't really like that. In other words, I don't know. It just, there wasn't that dynamic of geek yet. And anyway, that was before there was computers and stuff to sort of have that word. But then in high school, where that is definitely possible, I went to a magnet school. So yes, except there was a lot of people in that group where it wasn't really a problem. And in fact, like the star quarterback of the football team was also in my vector calculus class in senior year. So it's hard to,
you weren't an outlier in that way.
Yeah. I mean, there were still the cool kids and the geeks, and that was still true, but it wasn't, you know, like a bad 80s movie style thing. It was more like, well, that's what the school is.
Yeah. Everybody was, what's that character's name in Breakfast Club? Like there's like the clear geek character, but everybody was sort of that makeup is what you're saying.
Or enough. The critical mass to where like, it wasn't really like that. I mean, there was definitely the cool kids and the stoner kids and the geeks, like that was true, but it was more like, okay, so there are these different groups, who cares, as opposed to a hierarchy that mattered.
So how did you first encounter technology?
We had a TI-99/4A computer pretty early, and that had BASIC built in. This is a computer with 16K of RAM. So we had one at home, and you wrote the program everyone writes in BASIC, which is 10, print, JSON, 20, go to 10, enter. Then it, yeah. So there was that, and later on we got a Mac Plus, probably in the mid-80s, when that was a thing, which was pretty amazing, and things like HyperCard. But we did have it at home. And again, my mom was in, she was an administrator in the school district, so she had a degree in education. And then my father was a professor at UT. And so two teachers in the family. So like it was sort of set up for, oh, this is something that I have a proclivity for and an interest in and whatever. And so
they wanted to make it available.
Yeah, yeah.
So did you love it right away?
Yeah.
That became, yes, I did. Yeah. That became one of your early projects.
Yeah.
Beyond those, you know, early scripts and the early things that everybody did with BASIC, when did you feel like you were interacting with technology in a more advanced way, or in a way that was really fueled by your curiosity that was sort of beyond what maybe your peers were doing?
So when I was 13, I made a program for the Mac using a tool called HyperCard, in which I had a simulator for these little, I called them bits, but they were like little bugs with legs on them. And it was like Logo, where you could say, go forward 10, go left 30, and that kind of stuff. Except they also had things like eyes and smell and stuff. So they could, there was a variable in there where they could say like how much smell there was of some other bug. And so by, you know, going left and right, writing a program to go left, to go right, to try to seek where it goes more, it would like find the other one. It would leave a trail so you could see it trying. And then what if the other bug was moving? Like, how would it follow the other thing? Or what if it was the other one was moving randomly? Or what if the other one was trying to do the opposite? What if they were in a box where it was trying to do the opposite and run away, but there was also walls? And so would one eventually catch it, or could it stay away forever? What if they were going at different speeds? And so I wrote all of that. And then I wrote a manual. So there's like this, I still have it printed out, like this many page manual of how to do all this stuff as a user of this thing. And I had a really it's really funny in retrospect, but I had a funny like pitch almost. So again, you can see like the startup is there in the pitch, not in the money, but in the pitch. And the pitch was, you know, the problem with biological experiments is just there's so many variables. Like you can't control for everything, but you can here because like the only scent is the scent that is in the experiment, and the only, you know, and the light is uniform because it's a simulation. And, you know, obviously you also wouldn't learn anything about real biology. So
there's a finite number of variables and you're controlling for all of them.
Well, I left that part out. So, but there's like this pitch of why this is great for experiments.
How many hours do you think you spent on that?
Oh my God. Thousands. I mean, this was like a multi-year project.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And you had the stick-to-itiveness as a 13-year-old to have an idea and carry it through and stay with it.
Yeah. And I even have they printed out the manual a couple of times and there were different years in the copyright notice. So yes.
That's awesome. Yeah. In some ways, it sounds like you grew up in a family that was like particularly well-suited to help you really thrive given kind of who you came into the world as. So you had two teacher parents and your dad was a psychology professor, right?
Right.
I'd like to point out, go psychology. What else, how would you describe your family and kind of how they shaped you?
Well, my dad was more, less interactive and more like the person that you want to make proud. And then my mom was more, you know, a Jewish mother, like who loves her boy no matter what kind of thing. My dad used to say, you know, mommy will love you no matter what. That's between mommy and daddy.
Dot, dot, dot.
He was joking, right? But he was joking, but it still gives you the idea of like, but you need to, you know, do something. And of course, there's the old joke, which is so true, that in Judaism, a fetus becomes viable. Like how old does it be before it becomes viable? And in Judaism, a fetus becomes viable when it graduates from medical school.
Then you're a real person.
Yeah. So either you got to be a doctor, a lawyer, or business is like third. Successful business, then you're back up to the top tier. So I guess it worked out. I think the attitude, which they later said, which I think is true, is you want to let kids figure out what is a good match for them. And the trick is when they try something for a while and then they want to stop. And then the figuring out like, because everybody tries stuff and then wants to stop. Everyone goes through a dip. And then the question is, do they really need to be pushed through that? Because really this is right for them and they will see that later and they'll be glad that they got pushed. Or is this really a bad fit? And they're right. They should stop. And that's not good. And of course, you can't know the answer. You have to just try to do your best. And so I felt like that happened. So like I was doing basketball for a while and wanted to stop and I did. But then like 3 or 4 years into the piano, I kind of got into this dip and wanted to stop and they didn't let me stop. And that was good because then I got back into it. And, you know, I ended up taking lessons for maybe 15 years until college. And then even today, I try to play at home and I still have the piano that I grew up with, which is nice. So that was good that they pushed me through that. But certainly good that they did not push through basketball. That would be bad.
I don't know. You could have had a whole NBA career, oh, yeah. Jason. I feel like that's the path not taken for
right.
you.
Right. I could held the lens, take pictures of the players.
Maybe like a point guard. Are you an only child?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is great for me because I like to, you know, not be bothered by the other siblings and have all the attention and so on. That's good. Yeah, we have a 7-year-old daughter now, and she's also an only child, and we've talked about it before. Like, but even when we talk to her about it, she says that she's glad too. So
it works. I think actually both of my kids probably wish they were only children, but it didn't work out for them.
Yeah.
So neither of your parents were entrepreneurs in the traditional sense.
Oh, the reverse. They didn't understand it, and in fact, almost no one in the family. I guess no one was really an entrepreneur. Yeah, there's a lot of artists. My mom's sister is a taught photography at University of Akron in Ohio. Her other sister was also an artist. So it's like a family of artists and teachers. My dad's side, his dad was a professor and blah, 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 right? That kind of thing. So it's all teachers and artists. And then so me with computers, math, because I also got a minor in math in school. And then not getting a regular job. I mean, I did have a regular job actually for a while, but especially during college. But then, like, I'm just going to do something else that's not I don't even know what it is.
Were they freaked out by that? I mean, how did those early conversations go?
Yeah, but I think the notion was like for them was, you know, the worst case is this just doesn't work, and then you do go get a job. So, you know, so far it's been fine. So I don't think they weren't like against it. They just couldn't understand it or relate to it, and they were just like, I don't know what this is, but okay.
Right. So long as you don't come live in our basement, then it's fine.
My dad didn't want me to come back home. My mom, you know, like anytime.
Your mom will love you always. Your dad's like, okay, kid, you're done. Go.
Which, I mean, I didn't want to move back home, but I was always industrious in that way, too. Like, I worked all through college. I got a scholarship anyway, a full ride in college anyway, which my parents were thrilled at because they had saved up for college. Then I ended up getting a full ride. They're like, great. So they did pay my room and board for the first 2 years. They're like, great. We're keeping the money, though, except for here's the dorm money, you know.
Right. Here's a place to sleep. Yeah, and yeah. Now we're going to Tahiti.
But I worked all through college. Because I wanted to.
Yeah.
And that was a sort of regular job. It was at a startup, actually. But it was, you know, I did get a paycheck. I wasn't worried about that. So I was able to save up a bit. And so after college, I had a regular job for like 6 months and then had the first startup. And that's when I did say, you know, like, here's my line in the sand. If my savings get below this, then I'm going to stop. And, you know, that kind of thing to sort of be responsible about taking a risk. But again,
but they really supported that risk, certainly, yeah. As you made it a logical risk.
It was that's not even why. I think it was more meta than that. It was like I worked through college because I wanted to work. It's not like I'm not going to get a job. Like that's just not in me to not do. It's not going to happen. The very fact that I would construct a way to mitigate the downside of the risk is exactly why they don't need to be worried about it. Right.
They trusted you, obviously. Yeah. You know, one of the things that we've talked about in some of our personal conversations is you losing your dad when you were in college, right?
No, it was after college by quite a bit, actually.
Oh, okay.
He was diagnosed a year before I went to college, but they only told me when I was going to college.
Okay.
That's why. So I always think of it as when I went to college, but it was a year before. But since they didn't tell me, that's what, you know, is kind of in my mind. No.
The story of cancer didn't begin for you until you went to college, but you knew he was sick when you left.
Well, yeah, but the way it worked was I graduated from high school, and so it's the beginning of summer, and they say, well, your dad has cancer. We have to go to Little Rock. We live in Austin. We have to go to Little Rock, Arkansas for a bone marrow transplant, so we're going to be gone all summer. You'll move yourself into college. Bye. Oh, here's how to pay the bills.
Wow.
So I'm like, okay, so summer at home and then went to college. And so that was obviously an odd way to be informed. And
welcome to adulthood.
Well, but, you know, again, and they later said the reason was because it's difficult and why, I mean, it's a funny thing, but they were like trying to protect me in high school from the distraction. So you could argue whether that's good or bad. And whatever, it's again, like, I think as a parent, you just try to make some good choices. And not only if it's a mistake later on, not only should you just say, well, okay, everyone makes mistakes, but also it's not even clear if it is a mistake. There's something they're like, it's just not clear. So there's no, whatever, you just try to do the right thing. And that's that anyway. So, but he finally died in 2004. So that was 4 years after I graduated from college, 8 years after I left for college. So it was quite a while after that.
I mean, that seems like a, you know, significant thing to happen in your young adulthood. This is when, so you're 4 years after college, you'd started your first company by then.
Yeah.
Do you feel like he got to see a glimpse of who you would later become as a successful professional?
A glimpse, yeah. Because, well, the first company was a consulting company. It was okay. We got up to a little over $1 million in revenue a year, which is great. But then it very quickly went down to effectively zero and it was post-bubble. It was like, you know, 2001. And then it was post-bubble and then 9/11. It was like, oh, this is not a good time to do this. And so it dissolved. Then, though, in 2002 is when I started SmartBear, and also IT Watchdogs was at the same time. This is a complicated story, but basically there were two startups at the same time. And SmartBear I did on my own, and IT Watchdogs I had a co-founder. And the co-founder there, so I had started SmartBear. And IT Watchdogs guy, his name is Jerry, he's like, you should come do both of these things. And I was like, what do you mean? And he says, well, one will probably fail. So do them both and then just stick with the one that succeeds. Because at the time, Smart Bear was just a hobby. The software, that is, was just a hobby. I wasn't making money on it. And I had a good consulting job. So this was like the big leap to, because like consulting is obviously a company, but it's not a startup in the same sense as product or like a retail business or something. Consulting, there's almost never any startup funds needed. You just, you know, you sort of quit your day job when you get your first other job. And I'm not to say it's not difficult and all that, but it's not the same sort of risk and scariness as going to zero revenue.
Yes. And spend a bunch of time building something that maybe people will buy.
Right. Like it's not the same. It isn't the same thing. So I was worried about making that leap. And so I absolutely credit Jerry, again, like Jerry Cullen, my co-founder at IT Watchdogs, for making me take that leap. And his argument was actually kind of the same as I said earlier, which was, you can always just get a job. Like, it's, you know, you can always get a job. So just do it. So take a risk because you can. You're young and you don't have any attachments and so on. So just do it. Which, of course, he was right, but he still had to convince me. So I did both. And, of course, they both succeeded. And that was a problem because you can't do two startups, obviously. So I focused more on IT Watchdogs at first, and then as that one grew, I focused more on Smart Bear, and then eventually we sold IT Watchdogs in 2005, and then I was really able to only focus on Smart Bear. So that's how that sort of navigated. So it was at Smart Bear, and I guess IT Watchdogs too, but I was really kind of almost done with that when my dad actually died. So I associate all of that with Smart Bear, and I had one employee at the time. So I remember that time very clearly because, you know, there's only two people at the company, so you need everybody to be working all the time to make it work. And I remember him saying, like, you got to go. You got to, like, get out of here and go to the hospital and all that. Because my dad was in the hospital, of course, a lot. And I was at the hospital a lot, which is good. At some point, you do need a break of your own, right? And work is an escape from that. And that's, I think, you know, of course, that can be unhealthy. It could be used in an unhealthy way, but it also can be used in a healthy way. You can't just be in the hospital and stare at a monitor literally all of the time. That's not healthy either, right? So I was trying to navigate that. But anyway, I remember all that pretty clearly.
Trying to go back and forth between sitting with your dad and building your company. And
yeah.
How was it for you emotionally? Like, was that like a dark season in your life? Or I mean, it's just sort of hard to think about because on one hand, your career and the things, the projects that you've been working on are exploding and they're doing well. And then on the other hand, you're losing this really important person. Did you feel like you're sort of swinging back and forth, or were you kind of in that middle ground?
Yeah, it's hard because it was both at the same time. So it's hard to characterize it because you're right. Like Smart Bear was starting to really, really start taking off. And IT Watchdogs had, you know, was now in a good place. And so that was all really interesting and exciting and good, of course. I should also mention both those companies were bootstrapped, and that's useful because, of course, again, bootstrap companies and companies you raise money for are both very hard, but in separate ways. And there's different types of hard. Anyway, these were both in the bootstrap type, which is there's never enough time, never enough money, just trying to make it work. It feels like a 6-month-old where they're just trying to kill themselves all the time, and you're just trying to keep them alive. And that's like the state that they're in for a while until they finally kind of get enough mass that they can not be in that state. Whereas when you raise money, it's not that they're going to die. There's a year of money in the bank, but there's a different problem of how to put it to work. And anyway, it's different, more about people and stuff like that. But anyway, so they were both interesting. But the other thing with my dad is, again, it was 8 years. That's a long time to be facing and dealing with that. And toward the end, it was clear, like it was starting to go downhill as these things sometimes do. And so there's also this strange feeling of inevitability and sort of like the mourning process is dragged out in front of the event. So it's hard, obviously, but it's not like, oh, what a surprise. And now you mourn. And so it's like after it happened, it was almost like, well, I feel like I've been dealing with this event for a year already, you know? And so it wasn't, so that was kind of strange. I mean, I'm sure that's common, but it was, of course, for each individual person, it can be strange to actually go through it, even if it's extremely common, right?
Right. You could see how it would happen, but when it's you yourself and you're experiencing like maybe a little bit of relief or just, you know, that acceptance, maybe some peace, it's like, oh, this is an odd experience to be having right now.
So that was odd too. And I think people grieve or mourn or deal with those kinds of things differently. And again, it's hard to say if any one person, I mean, from the outside, if any one person's dealing with it well, whatever that means. So like in the immediately afterwards, again, I had felt like I'd sort of already dealt with it for so long that I dealt with it. And then, I mean, not that it's all over, but like, there's not a lot more coming. And then that was true. But then like 4 months later, something would hit me, you know, that kind of thing. And again, like, I'm sure that's common, but nevertheless, you know, when it happens to you, common or not, like, it's still a thing that you deal with, and it, you know, but what he didn't see is the sort of finality of some of these things, like actually selling IT Watchdogs or then selling SmartBear in 2007 or WP Engine, which is my current venture and is now the biggest, not just in things like revenue and whatever it customers it is, but kind of in what it means for the world. In other words, like, SmartBear was a good tool and it helped a lot of people, and that's good. But WP Engine is more like, we're the things we do for our employees. We have 450 employees and still growing. And the way in which we're able to open doors so people can have careers that they didn't have, that's what they say, and do things that they or even people in their family have not done before. Like, this is important on a different human level that has nothing to do with scale. It just happens that, oh, well, if there's more of that, then that's good. But it's not about, like, quote unquote, making a dent in the universe or something like that, but rather just on a human level, it's just a bigger impact.
And something you're super proud of.
Yeah, of course. Super proud of it. You know, and I'm also proud of the usual business metrics, you know, revenue growth and employees and customer count and crap. And I am proud of that. That is also hard. And if you're going to build a sustainable, enduring business, then that you have to have those things, right? Those are part of it.
All those 450 people need to be paid, I hear.
Yeah, right.
Like that. They'll stay around better.
And even selfishly, like, I want to, you know, have built a big company with a bunch of other people, of course. And, you know, I want to make a ton of money from it. You know, all that's selfish stuff, too. That as well. So, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting that as well. But I would say, like, at SmartBear, I wanted to make money. I also wanted everyone involved to. In fact, I gave away a lot of the company when I sold it. Some of my advisors were like, why did you give away so much of the company? Like, I don't know, because it's ours. We built, you know, we made it. So not just me, but everybody at the company, I wanted to make money when we sold it, but it was really about that, making money and selling it, right? And we did, and that's fine. But WP Engine, it's that, but there's all this other stuff, so it's much more meaningful. So he didn't see that, but he did see that, you know, things were starting to work, and like, maybe this risky choice was good.
He saw the beginnings of it, and he knew who you were.
Yeah.
What do you think he'd get, like the most kick out of? Like, what would he be most interested in or proud of?
Today, my daughter.
He's like, I don't care about your business. I care about my grandkids.
Oh, yeah, like, for sure. That, again, I had a very strict upbringing. Like, I didn't see many movies. The rule was no food with sugar in the first or second ingredient, sugar of any kind. So it was very, like, granola stuff and all that. I'm sure he would spoil my daughter rotten and, like, do everything that he didn't do, right? So that'd be fun. I guess, you know, being an entrepreneur is obviously a weird life, and just make that, it made it work. I think that would be good. But probably all the things I'm proud of, I would think it's the same type of stuff, right? Like, it's an accomplishment, and it means something. Besides that it's an accomplishment personally, it means something to many other people. You know, another thing on that same note, but one of the things that sort of, again, it's selfish, but it's meaningful from a childhood perspective is, so our building that we're in Austin, so we have locations around the world. We're in London and Limerick and Ireland and San Antonio and Texas and in San Francisco, but Austin is our headquarters. And about 2/3 of our folks are in Austin. Anyway, so we're in a building in downtown Austin, and it's at this particular corner, 5th and Lavaca, which is kind of in the middle of things. And we're now in about 60% of our building that we occupy. And so a couple of years ago, we got our name on the outside, you know, the big one that's lit up at night and all that, like the real name on the building, not the little plaque inside, but like, it's the WP Engine building now, right? And so obviously that's a great moment, just period. Like, your company's name is on a building downtown, like that's...
You're changing the skyline.
Yeah, like, that's pretty cool. You didn't build the building, so, but that you're still the heart of the skyline. And 5th Street in Austin is the primary artery to get to downtown if you're coming from the west side of town. So hundreds of thousands of people, you know, see that every day, and maybe more in, you know, if there's an event, right?
And your dad is a UT prof, would have kind of traversed that area a little bit, yeah?
And this is old Austin. You know, Austin has grown so much, but this is like core old Austin. This has been here since 1830, the street. So this is like, you really are, you know, changed Austin. Now, the reason I bring that up is when I was a kid, going downtown was like really special because you did it like nowadays in Austin, downtown has got all kinds of stuff. There's restaurants and a place to go and whatever, but not when I was growing up. It was like government, lawyers, and then that's it. And also it was kind of a ghost town. Like it had gone through a slump and a bust. And so like a lot of it was just boarded up. Like downtown was gnarly, but right on the edge of downtown, there was a bagel store and that's where we always got our bagels. And so on Sundays, we would go down Fifth Street and go to this bagel shop. And I remember in a car seat behind the driver's side, I would look out the window and I know we'd get to the – we'd be at the bagel place because there would be a building on the other side of the bagel place that had this long sloping ramped driveway that went up into the parking garage there. And I knew when I saw that long sloping thing, we're at the bagel place. But we never went further. Like we never ventured further into downtown.
That was the lie.
That and then run away, get the bagels and go. So that building with the sloping garage is the WP Engine building.
Wow.
That very building that was like ingrained like a duckling is ingrained on the mom, right?
In my you have an imprint.
Is the building. And I go up that driveway every day.
Wow, Jason.
And the That's bagel really store cool. is closed, sadly, because it was great. but like everything else in downtown, everything's $1 billion a square foot. And so you can't have a bagel store. It has to be some hipster cafe or whatever, right? Like that's the only thing that's going to work. So that meant a lot to me just from a personal perspective. And so the reason I thought of that is because when you said, what would he be proud of? Or what is my mom proud of now? Like that's maybe a nice microcosm of what would be proud of is like, now your name is on that building, like that kind of thing. Probably that.
Does your mom come down and see you at work?
She has occasionally. She doesn't do it a lot, but she does sometimes. So my mom has MS, and so it's hard for her to get around a lot. So she doesn't get around that much. But she has come, and there was one time when also her sister was in town, and every Thursday we have a town hall where we gather the whole company, which of course means as many as we can into the main conference room, and then like a constellation map of faces or like a Brady Bunch plus on the, you know, AV screen of all the other locations and rooms and stuff. And just for 30 minutes. And it's just like the, as Heather, our CEO says, the dinner table, you gather around good, bad, and the ugly. And so once a month we show all our numbers to the whole company, you know, how we're doing and just all kinds of other announcements and things. Right. And so they came maybe a year ago or so when we were doing our numbers and, you know, got to see all of that. And especially if I think you can be jaded if you read TechCrunch and feel like if you're not a $1 billion company, then why are you even bothering? Like that's the TechCrunch mentality, which is of course ludicrous. So you can get quite jaded there. But for an artist and a teacher to come see and like, we have these incredible numbers that are just sort of staggeringly big and see all the people and just see the culture. Cause you just feel the culture, right? Culture is what you see and what happens when you talk to anybody, that's what it is. And it's immediately apparent when you walk in WP Engine that, you know, what our culture is and how strong it is. So for them to just feel all that and see all that, that was really neat.
Were you watching your mom's face?
Yeah.
what was her expression like?
She kind of went like this. I'm trying to think of how to say this in words.
Like a little sort of proud swagger.
Of course. You know, she would like pull on people's shirts. She was sitting down. She would like pull on people's shirts. She was standing around her and she'd be like, that's my son.
That's my kid.
Everyone knew who the queen was. And why not? Good for her.
Right. She put up with a lot of projects and bought a lot of computers and, you know, lots of cheerleading.
That's for sure.
What are you most grateful for in, as you look back in your childhood, your early life?
Well, that's easy. I was born a cisgendered white male in Austin, Texas to two educated parents. Like, that's the genetic lottery. You don't have any excuses at that point, right? Like, sure, life can throw things at you and this and that, but like you don't really have any excuses. So for sure that. And so the question is, I mean, it's not something you apologize for. It just is, right? But you can ask, so what are you going to do? What are you going to do with that? And so what opportunities can you create for others? What is going to be important? What do you value? Like those are the questions that are interesting. Same thing with making a bunch of money. You know, I hope to make, you know, we've already built a company that's worth a lot. I hope that someday I'll make a shit ton of money from it. Okay, great. that's fine. And then the question once again is, and so what are you going to do? Right? Like,
how do you use your privilege well?
Yeah. There's nothing. I mean, I guess if our company were doing something that itself was questionable or exploitive, like we win because someone else loses, then it wouldn't be so great if we made a bunch of money that way. But that's not the case at all. And so we're a utility for the internet, like the water utility. So it's like, of course you need this. So it's not that way. So there's no guilt about that. But again, the question is only always, what do you do? And so that is why I'm proud of the culture and opportunities that we make at WP Engineering, because that's a big answer to what are you going to do? And so some of it is how we give back. In fact, our fifth value, when you walk in, you see them on the wall and we actually live them, unlike most of them, which are plaster on the wall, but people make fun of it because it's not true. So our fifth value is committed to give back. And so we do a ton of stuff. We give back to the open source communities for the software that we use a lot. We have full-time people who only give back to the community. So we really do that. Plus dollars as well. And also to the places we live, and obviously a lot in Austin, since that's where most of us are. So for example, we're one of the biggest donors to the local food bank. In fact, we may have been the single biggest donor last year as an organization. We volunteer our time as well into lots of different organizations. So there's a lot of ways in which we literally give back. But again, it's what we do for people at the company, where you also see that's not giving back, that's making opportunity. So, I mean, no one should be given a free ride or, a free pass, but everyone should be given a chance. And giving a chance is, most people don't get a chance. And so most people don't have the door opened that they have to then walk through. So, you can't get a promotion or whatever at WP Engine that's not deserved. That's just not a meritocracy. But so, for example, we're a high tech company. And so typically you expect a high tech company to have almost everyone has gone to college, but we have actually 35% of the employees have not gone to college at WP Engine. And 65% of our executive team are women, including our CEO and CFO, which obviously are especially usually not women, you might say. Even 50% of our leader, our management team in engineering are women. So everyone there is amazing. Like, there's no one there because, oh, well, they're just here because, again, like that's just not acceptable. And anybody who's ambitious and wants to be good doesn't want to be given something anyway that's not deserved either. Especially the folks who come in our support organization, which especially does not require previous knowledge of technology or schooling and all these kind of, prerequisites. That's where you really see people where there's not a lot of opportunities, not a lot of choice. And especially places where it's hourly. And then they do these tricks where, like, you get 32 hours a week. And that means they don't have to give you benefits. And then that means you need a second job. But now you're working like way too much. It just, that whole, and we don't have to get into all that, but basically it's a racket bordering on serfdom or, that kind of thing, really, many of those things. And so to have an entry-level position, because it's true that's what that is, but having an entry-level position that respects the individual and tries to make things go well. So, for example, we have a learning and development team, L&D team, inside the company whose job is to train our folks so that we can hire people that don't have this and that skill and then teach them the skills. And also, once they're here, we have training for how to get a promotion. So we have L1, L2, L3 in tech support where, you have more skills and you can solve these kind of problems. Of course, you have more abilities, technical abilities, that is, and also, customer service skills and whatnot, right? But we have training inside the company to help someone do that. That's what we want you to do, right? Now, you still have to do it. If you don't demonstrate those skills, you can't just get a promotion. That's not okay. But every opportunity to in fact do that. And then you have a lot of people, a good number of people where they have other proclivities and skills. So, like, they love spreadsheets. And so they actually like what finance is doing. Or a lot of folks come into support, and it's quite clear they'd be natural salespeople. But what sales organization would ever give them a job except for something like, I don't know, just cold calling some ridiculous thing that's not really a career, right?
You're totally the child of two teachers. I mean, it's just the sense in which you love watching people develop and, increase their capacity for opportunities because they're growing their skill set.
Yeah.
That's a pretty deep part of who you are and what you've been part of at WP Engine.
For sure. And so that you know, seeing people moving to other, you know, becoming engineers, becoming marketers, becoming salespeople, becoming finance people, as well as stuff inside support, or becoming account managers, becoming managers. You know, one of the typical problems in a company is, in terms of promotion or advancement, is that you advance up the org chart. But that's bad for at least two reasons. One is a lot of people don't want to be managers, wouldn't be good at managers, and shouldn't be managers. And that's fine. and so if that's the only way to get more responsibility and money and this and that, and that's not for you, like that, either you're going to do it and be unhappy and bad at it, or you're not going to do it and not going to, you know, either one of those is not a good outcome. The second thing is just mathematically, like if every manager has 6 to 9 direct reports, like, well, then they can't all become managers because only one can.
Right. The math doesn't work. Right,
the math doesn't work. So that can't be the way. But since it often is, then people have to change companies in order to have advancement, right? Which is much harder. And so at WP Engine, the idea is you shouldn't have to change companies to change jobs, have advancement, et cetera. You have to earn it again, but like how else can that be? So again, like, yeah, management's definitely a great way, but that should be like 1 in 6, just mathematically.
Yeah.
But there still needs to be the other 5 out of 6 ways. So, or opportunities, that is.
To go deeper and learn more and move up.
Anyways, so in terms of like real impact in people's lives or what proud of and everything, that's it. And so how to turn what are my obvious bestowed advantages for others and who don't have that necessarily. This is a pretty good mechanism, and you know, not to try to argue it's the most efficient one or da 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 da. And, you know, I don't know, but like we're certainly trying to do something for at the moment 450 people.
You can see how the story flows together. I mean, what you are naturally good at, you're good at like doing complex projects, but also teaching other people how to do it. I mean, I love that story about you writing the manual to the thing that you made. You know, it's not just, I made this, look, it's cool, but it's, I made this and I developed a mechanism to like bring other people in and bring other people along and empower them to, you know, create their own projects based on the structure that's provided. It's fun to talk about those early days and sort of who you became before you were shaped by the expectations of society or shaped by your success. And there's still a lot of deep connection to who you were as, you know, an 8-year-old to what you're doing now. And I think that's really neat. It also sort of makes me think that, you know, you're one of the folks who really was able to create the right situation for yourself. You're kind of, you know, doing what you should be doing, quote unquote, existentially.
I think that's probably true. Yeah.
Well, cool.
I don't know what else it would be.
But basketball? Come on.
Yeah, definitely not that.
Well, thanks, Jason, for chatting with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah,
appreciate you talking about your family. And it's always cool to hear your story and things you're thinking about.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll see you in Boston, if not before.
Oh, yeah, right.
All right. Take good care.
Okay, thanks. You too.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Zen Founder. Our theme song is A New Beginning by bensound.com, used under Creative Commons.